Chapter 20. Someone slapped me hard across the face. Dr. Cord, wake up! I forced my eyes open against an immense resistance. A blurred silver form resolved into a fresh-faced young man, dressed in the crisp, metallic uniform of the Interplanetary Service. A plasteel belt, a regulation issue blaster, the soft, glowing, semi-living pearl of the service sigil. Slowly, I recognized that it was Ensign Mortlock. He was leaning over my couch, undoing the fastenings as quickly as he could. "What is it, man?" I demanded.
"A problem while you were under, Doctor. A malfunction of the plastic educator. The tapes were scrambled."
Through a lifting mental fog, I asked, "Scrambled? What do you mean?" Hastily, Mortlock swung aside the hinged ensemble of visor and neural crown, nearly jarring my scalp in the process.
"Do you remember why you went under the educator?"
I forced my thoughts into order.
"I was due a routine reinforcement to keep my skills up to date. The tapes were refreshed on the last ether wave transmission from Earth. I've done it 100 times. Not the way it just happened."
Mortlock helped me to swing off the couch, my feet touching the cold grid plates of the deck.
"We got the wrong transmission on the ether wave. Instead of surgical skills, the tapes gave you a head full of stories."
I rubbed the prickling back of my scalp.
"My God! Now you mention it, all I remember are the strangest dreams. I've been on ships, all sorts of different ships. The time periods were different, but the ship was always called Demeter."
I reached out to him, desperate to verify his reality.
"And you were always there, Mortlock, and the others. Murgatroyd, Ramos."
I shook my head, a wave of righteous anger rising through me.
"How did this mix-up happen? Someone should be flogged for this."
"They don't know if it was sabotage or just a plain mistake, Doctor. The important thing is we realized there'd been a mix-up in time to pull you out. If you'd been under the educator much longer, the false patterns would have burned out the last of your ingrained surgical abilities."
I stared down at my hands, wondering if my fingers were still capable of the work for which I'd trained. For a moment there was nothing, and I feared the worst. The total obliteration of my identity as a man of medicine. A death worse than any other. For without medicine, I was directionless, without purpose. But then came an itching tingle in my fingertips. It was the remembered sensation of holding the humming titanium shaft of a pressor scalpel between them, and with that I knew that all was not yet lost.
"How did you learn about the mix-up?"
"Only when reports started coming through from the interplanetary liner Persephone. Well, they got the ether wave transmission that was meant for us. Their passengers were meant to enjoy a range of fictional narratives, and instead those poor dopes got the surgical patterns meant for you. No one knew anything was amiss until some of the passengers started trying to open each other up with butter knives. The tapes had given them an almost overwhelming need to do surgery."
I shook my head, disgusted and horrified in the same breath.
"Are they all right?"
"Just about, I think. They're getting them back under the educators now, trying to undo the damage. We'll do the same with you as soon as we get the correct patterns on the ether wave. We're a lot further out, of course, so it takes longer."
"Of course," I said, nodding as my memories came back into focus.
"Our mission beyond the thermal barrier to the ice planetoid. We were on our approach when I went under the plastic educator. It was the reason I needed to make sure my skills were as sharp as possible because of what we might encounter."
I shuddered, gripped by a profound sense that we had already run into catastrophe.
"Something happened, Mortlock. Something terrible. We went into that thing. They went in. They're still in there. The biometric traces."
"The what, Doctor?"
But Mortlock's concern gave way to understanding.
"It's all right. Really, it is. We're close, but we haven't got there yet. I reckon you're just reeling from the effects of the tapes, like someone who can't shake off a bad dream."
"That must be it," I agreed, anxious to accept such an explanation. "I've had bad dreams, though.
but even the worst of them can't compare with this. I squeezed my hand against the side of the couch. It felt as real and immediate as this, Mortlock. The last one was the worst of all. It was another spaceship, much more primitive than Demeter, like something from the last century or the century before that. A flimsy thing, powered by crude atomics. We'd crossed space to Jupiter and then melted our way through the ice of Europa into the subsurface ocean. I gave a head-rattling shudder. Oh, I must sound quite deranged to you. No one can blame you for being upset by what they put on those tapes, Doctor, Mortlock said soothingly. But the important thing is none of that was real. This is real here and now. Whatever those tapes tried to make you feel, you don't have to face any part of it now. Thank you. Then, gambling that my trust in him was warranted. Mortlock, I'm quite all right now, you realize. I understand what happened, and I already feel some distance from those false experiences. You don't need to make too much of my confusion when you report back to the others. I wouldn't want them to lose their confidence in my abilities. Lose confidence in you, Dr. Cord? There's not a chance of that. We were lucky to have you assigned to us, and we're still lucky now. Every man on this ship knows you're the best sawbones in the Interplanetary Service. His tone became gently insistent, as if he were the doctor, I the unwilling patient. Now, you take as long as you need to clear your head. We'll make sure you don't miss any of the excitement. No, but I want to, I answered, pushing aside my lingering misgivings. But something still nagged at me. Mortlock? Doctor? You mentioned the men on this ship. I presume that wasn't to the exclusion of Ada? Ada, sir? Ada Cosseel. He looked at me with some faint, renewed concern. There's no one called Ada Cosseel on Demeter, Dr. Cord. I think I'd remember if we had a dame among us. I said nothing. I stopped in my quarters on the way to the bridge, needing a stage of intermediate decompression before I flung myself back into the busy routines of the ship. With the door slid shut behind me, I seated myself at the room's console, scrutinizing every inch of my surroundings for reassurance. The dualloy walls, their plainness relieved by fretted accents of colored lighting. The secondary door, which allowed direct access to the medical bay adjacent to my room. The armored glass of the portal with the star-flecked blackness of space beyond. That was actual space, as deep, dark and empty as a pair of eye sockets, rather than some black ocean beneath a mantle of ice. My gaze flitted to the handful of personal effects dotted around the room. A three-masted schooner in a bottle. A yellow feather preserved in a block of resin. A tri-dye picture of a vine-shrouded cottage high on a hill with a glimmer of sea beyond it. An ornate box containing an antique French-made trepanation brace. A gift upon my graduation from the Interplanetary Service Medical School. It served as a salutary reminder of the horrors inherent in the healing arts before our present enlightened age. I breathed out. This was real, all of it. The lives I had lived under the plastic educator were the ersatz things, no matter how tangible they had appeared at the time, as the tapes impressed their patterns into the yielding clay of my neocortex. I was Silas Code. Respected, trusted, needed. There was no need to doubt any aspect of my nature. I'm Code, I whispered to myself. I'm Code. The troubling memories were fading, scoured away by the inherent reality of my surroundings. I understood now. The plastic educator worked differently depending on the recordings fed into it. The passengers on that liner would have been expecting to be fed seed patterns, fictional catalysts which their unconscious minds would then amplify,
furnishing them with quotidian details drawn from their own memories and surroundings. My mind had obviously operated on the seeds in the same fashion, drawing inspiration from these scattered personal effects. Instead of a ship in a bottle, I had dreamed of a schooner dashing itself on treacherous rocks. And as for the yellow feather, sadness touched me. I wanted her to be real. I had never imagined a lovelier tormentress than dear Ada in each of her manifestations. I mouthed, "I am glad none of that was real. Except for you, Ada. You are the one part I wish was true." I fingered the resin-shrouded feather, then, with infinite gentleness, placed it back where it belonged. I had stepped through the vac-lift doors onto the Bridge of Demeter too many times to count, but there had never been a time when the moment failed to stop me in my tracks. Among those who strode the hallways of the Interplanetary Service, very few made it as far as a frontline scout ship like Demeter, and still fewer had the privilege of treading the humming grid plates of the command room, that nucleus of a power and authority capable of turning worlds to cinders. As always, it was the windows which commanded my attention. Framed in duralloy and triple-plated against blaster fire, they formed a wide, curving sweep across 180 degrees of the bridge. The view beyond them was normally black, save for a scattering of stars and planets, but now the entire expanse was filled with the blazing white of the ice planetoid, towards whose face we were rushing. The ice planetoid, a menacing intruder from the spaces beyond the thermal barrier, trespassing into the solar system from that outer darkness into which only a handful of ships had ever forged. Our mission: to investigate both the ice planetoid and the alien anomaly within it, detected by remote scans but whose nature and purpose remained unknown. All eyes, biological and mechanical, were on that objective. Every man in the bridge had his absolute attention fixed on the task of our approach. Around them, consoles whirred and bleeped, tapes spooled and solenoids chattered, forming a repetitive, lulling background music, a chorus to the solemn professionalism of the men. The captain, Vanquisher von Voot, sat in the center of the bridge, ensconced in his throne-like control chair on a raised dais, with glowing gauges and levers laid out in an arc before him. His posture was one of supreme alertness, leaning slightly forward from his seat, one booted foot ahead of the other, his expression the steely concentration of a chess master. "Engines to idle," the captain intoned, his soft but commanding voice carrying to all corners of the room. "Bring us in on forward momentum while standing by on all pressure batteries. Delaminators to battle readiness."
"Pressure battery is warmed and ready," said Space Helmsman Murgatroyd, moving the heavy lever of a rheostat.
His artificial eye, token of the time he had seen action against the Venusian frogs, glittered and swiveled. While I had stopped in my cabin, Ensign Mortlock had come up to the bridge and assumed his position at the weapons console.
"Delaminator banks primed and ready for immediate discharge," he confirmed, flicking relay switches across his board.
"Well, Doctor, are you back among the living?"
asked von Voot pleasantly.
"An excusable error, however it happened. We must hope that no lasting damage was done."
"I believe I may still be of use," I said, flexing my fingers. "Ensign Mortlock got to me in time, thankfully. I dare not speculate about the effects of any further delay."
"If this was an error, someone will be flogged," von Voot said, echoing my own feelings as Mortlock had rescued me from the educator. "If it was sabotage, then the perpetrator, or perpetrators, will face the annihilation cubicles."
"Let us presume it was no more than an innocent error," I said. "After all, why would anyone want to sabotage the vital work of exploration?
It is my reputation they wish to sabotage, Cold, said our civilian guest, Topolsky, swiveling around from one of the monitoring seats set at a lower level than the captain's. I have nailed my colors to this mast, metaphorically speaking. My enemies would like nothing more than to see my venture turn to folly. The richest man in the nine worlds, by his own admission at least, the fur-clad, cigar-chomping magnate had used his influence within the Interplanetary Service to promote this military-scientific expedition to the ice planetoid. The correct recordings are arriving on the Etherwave as we speak, von Voots said, nodding at one of the spooling tape banks. If it was an attempt to damage us, or you, for that matter, Master, we may be confident that it has failed. His searching gaze fell on me, his eyes seeming to see right through me to some vastly more distant realm of space and time. He pressed a finger to his temple. Difficulties aside, you arrive at a propitious moment. We are about to detect the entry point. That was more than just calculated guesswork on the captain's part. Von Voot was a short-range psychic, able to detect and act upon events within a predictive horizon of exactly 13 minutes, 5 seconds. It was a skill that had helped in the war against the frogs, and one that had already saved this very expedition. A week ago, von Voot had swerved the ship to avoid a blazing asteroid that had slipped clean through our anti-collision screens. Without the captain's gift of foresight, Demeter would have been dashed against the rocks as surely as that doomed schooner of my imagination. I asked, "Do you foresee anything dangerous?" "No," he answered. "Not within my psionic horizon. A surprise, yes. Something we aren't expecting. But I can't exactly say what the surprise will be." He had described the physiological correlatives of this gift during his times on my examining couch. As events hove into view, they registered as distant, prickling impressions, mental thunderclouds without definite form. It was only when they came nearer in time, emerging fully over that predictive horizon, that he was able to assign clear shape and meaning to these phantasms. I know that others envied him this capability. I did not. I only had to imagine how the gift of foresight would have guided my hand as a surgeon. If I knew in advance whether a given incision was going to lead to success or catastrophe, I would become a mindless instrument of predetermined forces, no better than a robot or electronic brain. "I am so glad you are here for this moment of our triumph, Code," Topolsky said. "What we are about to glimpse will render our names immortal. Our fame will bestride the spaceways. The frogs may have tested us with their deviousness and low cunning, but they will never any match for the intellects of proud-born Terrans. Now we stand on the threshold which we have earned. First men to witness the work of minds truly superior to our own. If we make it back to Terra with all hands safe and well, Master, that is reward enough for me." "Ah, such humility of purpose. Such selfless devotion to the Hippocratic principle. It gladdens the heart."
"Visual contact," said Murgatroyd with rising excitement. "It's there, Captain, dead ahead of us, just as you predicted." "Delaminate is its firing potential," said Mortlock, as numerous dials twitched across his console. A hole lay ahead of us, a throat-like fissure leading down into the interior of the ice planetoid, a tunnel bored by the object of Topolsky's interest, the edifice, as he called it, as it came hurtling in from the outer void.
"Engines stop," von Voot intoned. "Pressures and tractors to power. Take us down the center of the bore, Murgatroyd. Steady as we go."
The space helmsman's fingers danced effortlessly across the glowing panel. Demeter descended the shaft, rocket tubes pulsing to keep her on course, the flashing of their exhausts reverberating against the fluted walls of the shaft.
The stutter of re-radiated light made me think of a distant electrical storm. There's always lightning. Although the ship's descent had put her onto a nearly vertical tilt, the artificial gravity never wavered. Steadily, we moved down the shaft, Murgatroyd calling out units of depth every mile, and with our point of entry slowly diminishing above us, until, on the rear-facing viewplates, it was nothing more than a black disk surrounded by a darkening fringe of ice. Still standing, I clenched my fist against an oppressive, unwanted recollection. That of an airship, sinking into the belly of the earth in nearly similar fashion. That had been quite impossible, though. The men of an earlier age, their minds still wreathed in ignorance, might have been open to the possibility of holes in the earth, passages admitting entry to the hollow realm within. But in our super-scientific age, we knew better. And yet, that infernal plastic educator had sowed the seed of the idea in my mind at such an indelible level, even now, knowing it to be a fiction, I could not bring myself to dismiss it entirely. The noises and smells of that gas-powered airship were as real in my recollection as any lived experience. I had been there, just as surely as I had been on those earlier iterations of Demeter which ploughed the seas rather than the air. No, I asserted to myself, I had not been there. It was unreal. Each iteration was a lie, including, by logical extrapolation, the fourth such exemplar. The one that I had been in before waking to this.
Something ahead, Murgatroyd called out, as a red light on his console began to pulse on and off, accompanied by a subtle but ominous modulation in the background music of the bridge. Scanner contact. Something small and metallic lodged in the walls of the shaft about 2 miles below us.
Estimate the fix, von Voot said.
270.3, 6.8, 1.61, intoned Murgatroyd.
With a chatter, a teletype reeled from his console. He tore the end off and leaned across from his console to pass the paper stub to Ensign Mortlock.
Alert condition red. Ensign Mortlock, concentrate pressure batteries on that reference. Locking in, Mortlock said, setting his own dials and levers by the numbers on the printout. Press is locked and compensating. Reduce descent rate by half, Space Helmsman. Ensign, fire at will at the first indication of hostile intent.
Aye, aye, Captain.
I would like to be consulted before any such action, said Coronel Ramos, Topolsky's military advisor.
He was a huge, bald bull of a man, his chest cross-webbed by bandolier pouches containing blaster cartridges. He had to raise his voice over the insistent bleating of the red alert alarms.
I need not remind you that my employer has staked a great deal on the investigation of the edifice. There will be little consolation if all he has to pick through our charred remains.
We aren't deep enough to pick up a contact from the edifice, said Dupin,
the precocious, tousle-haired maths prodigy who had been hired onto the expedition to solve such riddles as lay beyond the reach of Demeter's own analysts and logic banks.
Unless the thing has moved from its last estimated position, we won't catch sight of it for another 8 miles. Whatever the scans are picking up, it's something else.
You are sure of that? Topolsky asked.
I am sure of most things, Master,
the boy answered, unflinchingly.
Contact is holding, Murgatroyd reported. Whatever it is, it's no more than 6 or 7 feet across. Too tiny to be a ship.
But not too tiny to be a frog blaster, mine, mouthed von Voot, who had reason to be suspicious of small metallic objects.
Yet, if it were a Venusian trap, would it not be better disguised?
Can we see it yet? I asked.
Just entering visual range now, Doctor, Murgatroyd said. Captain, may I put it on the main viewer?
Von Voot gestured loftily. Do so. The view through the central part of the main window shimmered like a watery reflection, and then resolved into a close-up of part of the shaft wall. Instantly we saw the source of the metallic trace, a gleam of yellow, as stark against the dirty white of the ice as a nodule of gold in a prospector's pan. The shape of the thing was difficult to make out in the vague focus of the long-range scanner. It could have been a piece of cosmic debris, a chunk of foreign rock, the curled-up husk of a man-sized alien spider, or something worse. But I knew it to be none of these things. "That's Ada Cassile," I blurted out, before I could censor my own words. Mortlock turned from his console to look at me. Doubtless he remembered our awkward exchange after the ordeal of the plastic educator.
"The Cassile, is that a term with which I'm unfamiliar?"
Von Voot asked reasonably.
"Some kind of mineralogical or chemical terminology?"
I had seen her clearly. She had been in a yellow spacesuit, crouching on all fours on a treacherously narrow ledge with the sheer drop of the shaft beneath her. I had not needed to see her face or any other identifying features. Who else could it be but the regal psychopomp of my dreams? She was back, despite everything. Despite the fact that she could not possibly be real.
"1 mile to contact," Murgatroyd said. "Scanner's improving."
Something moved within my chest as the image on the main viewer wobbled and reinstated itself, coming back at a higher clarity. I both wanted and did not want it to be her. I wanted to see her face again, to know that she was something more than a dream figment. But in the same instant, I desired nothing less than her total non-existence. Because the mere fact of Ada Cassile opened a door in my mind, a portal into something which I did not wish to face. The image sharpened further. To my despair and relief, I saw that it was not Ada Cassile. It was a chunk of crumpled yellow metal, a piece of hull plating that had been torn off and buckled and mangled so that it might, for an eye blink, by someone who desired, or feared it to be so, be taken for a crouching human form.
"Duralloy composition," Murgatroyd said. "Partial markings legible. You, perhaps you're..." "It's not frog," Mortlock blurted out. "It's one of ours."
Von Voot nodded somberly.
"Indeed it is. The remains of some poor vessel that strayed this way before us."
Cautiously, he added,
"Alert condition, Amber. Resume normal descent speed."
11 further miles we went down that chimney, until we emerged into the lightless space which formed the hollow middle of the ice planetoid. Still at condition Amber, Demeter dropped a mile or two into that abyssal space, her instruments and screens twitching against the tiniest speck of cosmic dust which had somehow found its way into that unfathomable void. Our searchlights sprang on, stroking the canopy of ice above us, casting enormous arcs of yellow radiance. Strange, tubular forms wormed across the ice, grey-green against its pearly luster. The searchlights traced along these tentacular forms, following them as they thickened and united, as if we were tracking down the branches of some immense tree or river delta, groping our way towards the primal source from which they radiated. Suddenly, it was in our lights, projecting down from the ice like the rotten tip of some terrible misshapen fang, puncturing in from above. It was more than 1,000 feet deep and wide, a mountain-sized nugget of a curious, twisted and bulging form, convex and concave, smooth in some areas and rough-formed in others, like a patterned carpet that had been rolled up and knotted over and over again until nearly all sense of its form and nature lay concealed. Dupin was making strange, stiff gestures with his hands,
framing angles and intersections like a critic trying to find some sense in a piece of modernist art.
"The geometry,"
he murmured.
"The geometry, I think I can see it. Each quarter section is homeomorphic to a triangle."
He stared back to us, wide-eyed and uncomprehending of our own inability to visualize what was plain to him.
"Can't you see? It's beautiful and hideous. It's not right."
"Alien minds conceive this form," said Topolsky, with a faint dismissiveness. "Minds far beyond our ken. Their notions of aesthetic propriety are as old to us as our classic proportions would be to them."
"There is more to it,"
Dupin said, his forehead a mirror of sweat.
"Something did this. Something twisted it. I think it went through some topological mishap, an accident of geometry. A wrinkle in the hyperspace manifold. An FTL jump that went wrong, leaving it malformed. But I need to be more precise, sir."
He pressed fingers to his brow, digging in with his nails.
"I must specify the exact set of transformations. Near enough isn't good enough. Near enough won't help. I can't fail."
"Easy," I said, seeing a vein bulging on the side of his temple.
"No. I've got to solve it. I must solve it if we are to escape."
"Escape?" Topolsky asked. "Why do you speak of escape, man? We haven't even got there yet."
"I must be allowed to use the cerebral augmenter," Dupin said pleadingly. "It's all I need to make the final breakthrough."
"You disagreed when we last discussed this, Doctor?" said Van Voet. I nodded at the captain. "The cerebral augmenter has rarely been tested beyond interplanetary service laboratories. The men who used it then had all had many years of experience under the plastic educator, and still it took its toll on them. Yes, it can boost the subject's intellect for a limited interval, allowing them to perform superhuman feats of mental agility, but at a considerable cost. Under service rules, the cerebral augmenter is to be considered an instrument of last resort when all other measures have failed and there is but one chance to save a ship and its crew."
"Thank you, Doctor," the captain said. "Mercifully, we are not yet in that position."
Dupin looked at me despairingly.
"You tell him, Dr. Code. Tell him what's really happened to us. Tell him we're already inside it. Tell him we've been inside for months. Tell him we're all dying in here. If no one helps us, we'll end up like the others."
"Master Topolsky," said Von Voet, "you have clearly been working Monsieur Dupin beyond the point of exhaustion. I will not have him on my bridge in this confused, distressed condition. Have him removed and forced to rest."
"Your orders do not extend to my party," Topolsky said. "If I deem that he is still useful, then it is my decision whether he leaves or remains."
Von Voet stiffened in his command chair. "Then let me make a polite request. It will be better for the boy, for you, for all of us, if he were allowed to rest. Might Colonel Ramos be so kind as to see that it is so?" Before Topolsky could frame an objection, Ramos raised his massive bulk from his own observation console. His blaster cartridges gleamed on his bandoliers.
"I will see him back to his quarters, Captain Von Voet. You are right that it will be better for us when his mind is rested."
"Thank you, Coronel," said Von Voet, easing slightly. The burly, boulder-headed Mexican offered a companionable hand to Dupin, and when that was ignored, he gently but firmly took the boy under the armpits and elevated him bodily from his chair. Dupin, in his troubled, dreamlike state, offered no opposition. He was as pliant as a rag doll, his heels brushing the grid plates as Ramos half-carried, half-dragged him to the waiting doors of the vat-lift.
"Silas," Ramos said, eyeing me. Perhaps you should come as well.
An uneasiness delayed my answer. Yes, yes, I should indeed attend. With your permission, Captain?
Do so.
Coronel, would you be so kind as to bring the boy to the medical room, rather than his own quarters? I would prefer to keep him under close observation until I'm satisfied with his progress.
Of course, Salas.
I was just about to step into the vac lift, joining Ramos and the boy, when Murgatroyd spoke out suddenly.
Captain, there's something up there, jammed against those rough parts like a fly burned onto a light fitting. It looks like a ship, like... His throat seemed to dry on the words. Just like one of ours.
I did not bother turning around. There was no need. I already knew exactly what it would turn out to be. I could have even told them the full name of the ship from which that hull plate had been ripped. Ramos laid Dupin down on the bunk in the medical bay. With a tenderness belying his size and reputation for ferocity, Ramos drew the woven plasteel blanket over Dupin's shivering form. Above the couch's headboard, indicators detected his vital signs and began to respond accordingly.
He has a fever, Silas.
I'm surprised he has anything left to give, the way Topolsky has been driving him. There's only so much a body can take.
It is not all Topolsky's fault. The boy would work himself to exhaustion, whether or not he was being asked to. This mania of his will be the death of him, given time. But he will not mind, so long as his name is attached to something more than a footnote.
I'm not sure I would trade my life for a posthumous reputation. Ramos smiled kindly.
But then you are not Raymond Dupin. I do not think you or I can really understand what it's like to be him. The cerebral augmenter may seem like a devil's bargain to men such as you or I, but our minds were never brilliant to begin with. We cannot judge.
Nothing could matter enough to allow a man to burn out his own mind just to seek some abstract mathematical solution.
And if it were not abstract, if the fate of Demeter truly depended on his insights, if he was the only one of us who could make use of the augmenter in a decisive fashion?
No matter what the regs say, I still wouldn't agree to it.
Master Topolsky will say that he does not need your agreement. Reluctantly, I will have to accept his opinion. Besides, what will be the crueler thing? To allow the boy that ecstasy of insight, or deny it him forever?
My only duty is to the welfare of the crew. There are no circumstances under which I would ever consent to treating Dupin like a pile of matchwood, to be burned for our convenience.
We all have our certainties,
Ramos replied.
The only thing of which I am certain is that all men have a point where their minds may change.
Not mine, I asserted.
I will not be so sure.
Ramos moved to the desk where the cerebral augmenter lay in its duralloy box. He opened the lid and extracted the double-lobed apparatus with its close-fitting crown and bulbous, earmuff-like inductor modules. What are you doing?
Examining the apparatus. Is it accidental that you asked for him to be brought to the medical bay, Silas? He would have been no worse in his own room with a guard to keep him from overexerting himself. Yet, the cerebral augmenter has been in your possession since we left Terra.
Because it is experimental mental equipment, its use falls under my responsibility. Put it away now, please. Dupin stirred. His eyes opened to slits, and he seemed to latch onto the object still within Ramos's grasp. Reaching an arm out from beneath the plasteel sheet, he beckoned at the cerebral augmenter as if it were a vision of heaven itself, a celestial city breaking through clouds.
Please, he whispered. I must have it.
You fool, I snarled intemperately. You've only made him more agitated.
How easily the bonds of friendship fray, Ramos answered.
This is a torment, I retorted.
The real torment is in denying the boy the thing he craves.
Dupin was straining now, leaning up from the couch, sweat pearling his brow and his cold eyes fixed wide on the prize.
"Just a minute under the augmenter," he said. "That's all I need."
"Nothing matters this much," I said.
"Everything matters, Doctor, everything matters. Oh, please let me have it."
Some bargaining calculation worked behind that glistening brow.
"You can say it was too dangerous and I won't ask again. But just give me 1 minute. That's all I need. I know it. I can solve the problem of eversion if only I have that minute. Then I can give you the path."
I frowned. "The path?"
"The path you need. To find your way through it. To reach the others."
"The others?" Spittle foamed around his lips.
"Others? No. Not others. Us. To reach us. To help us get out. You need my solution. You need me."
"If it eases his troubled mind," Ramos reminded me in a near whisper, "would 1 minute really do so much harm?"
"It has left men gibbering after 45 seconds, never mind a minute. The worst of them pleaded to be sent to the annihilation cubicles rather than live with the ruins of their own sanity."
"It is his choice. Whatever he is going through now, it is surely beyond anything the augmenter could inflict."
The cool logic of the coronel reached through my defenses. Stated in those terms, the dilemma had only one ethical resolution. If my obligation as a doctor was to do no harm, then in denying him the augmenter, I was in violation of the most fundamental tenet of my profession. 30 seconds, I said. "That is all I'll allow. Most men have endured that interval, albeit with varying after-effects." Ramos clearly sensed that I was beyond negotiation.
"It is the right thing, Silas."
"You have forced my hand on this, remember that."
"It need not be on your conscience."
"Good," I said, brusquely. Ramos moved to the boy. As he brought the cerebral augmenter within reach, Dupin lunged for it, snatching it from the coronel's hands and ramming it down over his sweat-matted crown. Nothing happened, of course, for the augmenter was operated by a set of remote controls built into a portable console encased within the hinged lid of the duralloy container. I flipped the first of 2 switches. "Power to cerebral augmenter." A hum and a red glow emanated from the apparatus. I observed the telltale lights on the console. "Power stable. Hold him, Ramos." He braced the boy firmly, but gently.
"I am."
Eyeing the clock above the desk, I worked the 2nd switch. "Commencing induction." Dupin stiffened, his jaw tensing as he threw back his head in an ecstasy of elevated intellect. The humming intensified. The red glow became an angry throb.
"I can see it,"
Dupin strained to speak, his voice broken by awe and terror.
"The bounding loops. A to H, I to J, J to A. The intersection of Section East with itself. The ordering of the quintuple points. I could not see it, but now I see it."
"Easy," I murmured, as the clock hit the quarter-minute mark.
"The sections form a tetrahedron. The tetrahedron is homeomorphic to a sphere. Self-intersection has been achieved."
The clock indicated 25 seconds. My finger hovered over the switch, ready to de-energize the augmenter.
"Just a little more," Dupin shrieked. "I must verify the solution. You'll only have 1 chance to get it right. There isn't time to make another mistake."
"Give him what he needs," Ramos said.
"No," I said, flicking the switch. 30 seconds in that thing is more than enough. It'll already have felt like an hour to him." Dupin slumped back, mentally exhausted, as the apparatus quietened its humming and the red glow paled to nothing. Ramos removed the augmenter, quiet concern on his face.
Was it enough, Dupin? Did you see what you needed to see?
Dupin breathed slowly. His eyelids fluttered. He rubbed a knuckle against his lips, dragging loose a scurf of foam.
I saw it. I understood. I wanted to verify.
His eyes welled with tears.
You should have let me verify. If they find a mistake in my analysis, they won't remember me.
I have faith in you, Ramos said. There was no error in your analysis.
Then, with a fearful edge to his voice,
do you remember it?
Yes,
Dupin exclaimed.
Of course, I...
There was a knock. Instinctively, I turned to the door before a ghastly dawning awareness informed me that the sound had not come from within the ship, but from outside. It had originated on the opposite side of the little cabin from the direction of the portal in the outer wall. The knock came again. Wordlessly, I moved to the portal. A sliding duralloy shield was down across it. I flicked a lever, and the shield whisked aside.
What is it, Silas?
Ramos asked, still regarding the boy with sympathy. I looked out through the portal. Ada Cosil was just outside. She was in a tight-fitting yellow spacesuit of antique design, the sort that belonged to an era of flimsy ships and crude atomics. A mission patch, the flags of forgotten nations. She hung onto the outside of Demeter, one hand gripping a service rail, the other waggling a finger slowly in front of her faceplate. Her face floated beyond the gold-mirrored surface of her visor. Her lips moved, and I read them with the effortlessness of dreams.
Let me in.
The visor fogged and cleared itself. Beyond it loomed open sockets, two vertical slits where a nose should have been. Beneath them, a grinning maw of tooth and bone. I screamed until the world melted. Chapter 21.
Good,
Ada Cosil said, still crouching before me in her yellow resistance suit.
You're back in the room. I've got to give you credit, coming up with a fantasy which not only rationalizes all the previous ones.
She shook her head admiringly.
I had to work hard to reach you in there. Do you remember when I told you we had 200 hours at best? Strike that. We're now looking at something nearer to 150. I lost you in there for another 2 days, Silas. We can't afford to have that happen again.
I mumbled. There's always lightning.
Yes, good. That's important. There's always lightning. You'll understand why a little later on, but that would be getting ahead of ourselves just now. What matters is you. We'll get nowhere until you finally deal with the fact of what you are.
I'm Silas Code, I said numbly. Dr. Silas Code.
You're code, Silas. Computer code. Specifically code written in the Silas programming language. Between friends, that's the self-interrogative language for autonomous systems.
No.
You are what you are. No point in fighting it anymore. You're an expert medical system. You're a very advanced suite of adaptive software routines running on the computer core of Demeter. You're not a doctor. You're not even a man. That's why you aren't on the mission patch, because you're not alive.
Fuck, you never were. You're just proprietary software with a glitch. A really bad glitch, admittedly, but still one you need to snap out of. I'm a man.
You're a program that wants very badly to be a person, Silas. So badly you've forgotten that you aren't one of them. But that ends now, all right? We haven't got time for any more of this shit. If you truly want to help people, you've got to stop kidding yourself about what you are. You're like this ship, like that fucking thing out there. You're an artifact, a machine.
No.
Silas, don't go crashing on me again. We really don't have...
Chapter 22. Inside the wreck of the scout ship Europa, Ramos passed me the logbook, opening its duralloy covers to the last completed page. I stared at the entry, if that was what it could be deemed. It was a scrawl, cutting diagonally across the silvery material, gouged so deeply into the paper that the stylus had nearly ripped its way through. It said, "Leave if you can," with a slanted line trailing away from the last letter, forming a violent slash that ran all the way down to the edge of the sheet. It was as if, I tried to push away the thought, because it was both absurd and terrifying. It was as if the person who had left this message had been dragged out of the ship, even as they tried to leave a warning. I passed the logbook around, let the others form their own judgment. No one made light of it. Even Ada Cassil, who had always been with us, found the fortitude not to make some bitterly sarcastic observation. "Dare we frame a hypothesis?" I asked. Topolsky sighed over the short-range etherwave channel which linked our suits.
"I fear you're about to."
"I think it may already be too late to heed this message. Too late for you, anyway, Master Topolsky."
"And for you, Cold?"
"Oh, don't worry about me. I'm already dead. In fact, I'm starting to wonder if I was ever alive in the first place."
"What are you babbling about, man?"
"This isn't real," I said, gesturing around me. "It's a mental construct. It's a fiction imposed on the bones," I stammered, "on the bones of reality. You all exist, but not in this fashion. There's a ship, Demeter, but it's nothing like an interplanetary service scout ship, and Europa's nothing like this either."
"Control yourself, Code."
I laughed back at him. "There's nothing to control. I've been generating this reality and the others and populating them with you because I both can and can't face the reality which we're in. Part of me wants to, part of me doesn't. So I've been circling around the truth like a fifth-rate schooner caught in a whirlpool, allowing myself to get near, but not too near. Because if I'm too close, I have to deal with the fact of my own nature and..."
"Oh, have pity on him," Cossiel said, tucking her arm into the crook of mine. "First I'm here, then I'm not. Then I'm back again. It's been an awful torment for him. And who wouldn't find it an awful torment knowing what he knows? The poor dope is stuck in about the worst possible dilemma. He wants to save as many of you as he can, because that's his duty, his function. But he can't do that unless he acknowledges the thing that he really is. That's a little death in its own right."
"Do you remember any of it, Master?" I asked him. "Norway? Patagonia? The Sims Hole?"
"I wish we had the luxury of a second doctor," the magnate lamented. "Then I would gladly have you certified as unfit to continue your duties." "In the meantime," Ramos purred, "there remains this. What are we to make of it?"
He leafed through the last few pages in the logbook, his bare fingers scuffing against ink-stained paper. Instead of duralloy plates, the book was bound in stiff black leather. That was not the only anomalous thing. Rather than the regulation vacuum equipment of the Interplanetary Service, Ramos wore boots, breeches, and a heavy long-hemmed coat of distinctly maritime cut. The leather sheath of a scimitar or similar hung from his belt. He slowed in his perusal of the book, as if for the first time becoming aware of the incongruity of his attire and armament. He looked at me with a queer horror, as if he too understood that things were terribly out of joint.
"What is becoming of us, Silas?"
Chapter 23. Cossiel stared at me. I stared back. Around us, Demeter made the muted noises of limited life support. "Where was I?"
"You regressed again," she said, "back into your narrative construct. It's beginning to fracture now, beginning to lose coherence. Details are bleeding between realities. That's good. It's encouraging. It's a sign that you're finally making the transition to complete acceptance of your nature.
Cossiel grimaced.
But it's cost us even more valuable time, Silas. If we're going to do anything for the others, we have to act now.
I looked down at my hands, examining them with the unsparing eye of a diagnostician. I can't be code, Cossiel. I'm here, breathing and real. I touched a finger to my opposing wrist. I'm warm. I've got a pulse. I'm a human being, just like you. She shook her head.
You're wrong about both of us. I'm no more a living person than you are.
No, I exclaimed in flat denial. You're sitting right next to me. If I ran a diagnostic test on it, you would tell me what I already know. You're a living person, a member of the crew. Just because our names aren't on the mission patches.
I'm not, Cossiel sighed. Oh, Silas, please try not to regress. I know this is difficult, but you've got to make an effort. Your software. Clever, adaptive software, admittedly, but no more than that. You have no existence except as a set of instructions executing on a computer. This body of yours, the one you think you're wearing, is a self-generated illusion. Of course it seems real to you. You've constructed your self-image according to the anatomical models in your database. Pinch your skin, and it has exactly the same elasticity as real skin for a man of your assumed age. But it's a fiction. You're not sitting inside this cabin. The ship is empty.
But I've moved around inside it.
You've merely synthesized a point of view. A virtual focus which can travel anywhere inside Demeter where there are cameras and other monitoring systems. You could see all the ship at once if you wished, but that would mean accepting what you are. A bodiless pattern of instructions haunting a ghost ship.
But I've helped them, I said, with rising desperation. I operated on Ramos. I can remember exactly how it went. I was there.
You weren't there. You directed robotic surgical devices in the medical bay. You were software running hardware. Again, you've overlaid a fiction on what really happened.
But what about you, Cossiel? You said the ship is empty. How can it be if you're sitting there? Her eyes bored into me.
Do you want the truth or something beautiful? I'm just like you. I'm also just a bunch of instructions running on Demeter.
Chapter 24. Ramos, with his blaster before him, was the first to step over the ragged threshold of the edifice into the darkness beyond. Half a minute passed before he called through on the general wireless that it was safe, in, of course, a strictly relative sense, for the rest of us to follow. Not wanting to steal even a glint of glory from Topolsky and his associates, I held back until nearly the end, when Mortlock encouraged me to step through.
"I'll bring up the rear, Dr. Code, if that's all right. Whatever it was that got those fellows in the paddle steamer, we don't want anything creeping up behind us."
We had emerged into a dark, cavernous space, whose exact shape and extent our Davy lamps could only probe at. The best impression I could arrive at, imperfect as it might have been, was that we had broken through into a sort of tunnel, extending away from us to the left and to the right, but which was also stuffed with looming machinery and apparatus. Enormous shadowy forms, bulbous and tube-like, whose function we could only guess at. Sinuous tube-like things of varying diameters threaded along the tunnel, appearing and disappearing from the gloom in either direction. They were coiled and looped around each other as if they had grown with a sort of parasitic vigour. Some were no thicker than elephant trunks, while others were as wide as tree trunks. Even at their most slovenly, this bore the hallmark of no human engineer.
"It makes me queasy just looking at them," Mortlock said. "I feel like I'm crawling around inside someone's guts."
"That may be not too wide of the mark," Topolsky said, sheer curiosity now winning out over his earlier apprehension. if this object has come from some hitherto uncharted part of the globe, a true terra incognita, it may be quite ancient by our reckoning, yet fully capable of rejuvenating, nourishing itself when it chances upon raw materials. These may indeed be the digestive conduits of some enormous stomach.
Then let us hope it is still working on its last meal, I said.
The men, Mortlock said. The ones from the other ship. Do you think...
He trailed off.
Spit it out, man, Topolsky snapped. I was only wondering, sir, if this thing does need to feed, could the other men, including the one who left the note, could the other men have been eaten?
More to calm Mortlock than out of any certainty on the matter, I said, I think it unlikely. A machine of this size would gain almost nothing by digesting a few explorers in their suits. It would be like a starving man scavenging for breadcrumbs. Even the ship would provide insufficient nourishment, which is why the wreck has been left as it is.
Hmm, said Mortlock, doubtfully. I know you meant to put my mind at ease a little, Doc, but now you've put the idea of digesting in there, and I'm not sure it's any improvement.
We may have much to concern ourselves with, I said, with a heavy candor. But I do not think being eaten or digested is one of them. Mortlock was not placated.
Then what did it want with the men it dragged inside?
That, I fear, is an entirely different question. Perhaps when we find them, we shall learn for ourselves. We advanced to the left, stooping under mighty tubes and swellings, squeezing our way through constrictions, clambering over vast roots and python-like coils, for all the world as if we were forging ever deeper into some darkening jungle made of metal, rather than vegetative and animal matter. It was impossible to avoid contact with any part of the machine, quite aside from the fact that we walked upon it. Impossible, too, to ignore the constant presence of some distant humming process, a faint but steady reverberation which found its way into our suits as insidiously as any siren song.
It lives, Topolsky said. They all live, Ramos murmured.
He shook his helmeted head after this utterance, as if it had come from a part of himself he did not quite recognize, yet bearing a truth he could not deny. The injury, I declared aloud to myself. The injury that I treated, the only serious injury on the entire expedition. I did something, or changed something in Ramos.
Stop whittling, Doctor, Topolsky said.
Ramos remembers, I answered. You do not. But that is because you never needed my emergency intervention, but Ramos did. Concussion? Or was it a bleed on the brain? I went in. Radical neurosurgery with neuroprosthetic monitoring for post-operative complications.
Went in where, for pity's sake?
Into his skull, I said. I trepanned him north of Bergen, or was it south of Montevideo? He hit his head on a bit of tackle falling from the rigging. Ramos touched a gloved hand to the side of his helmet.
Of course. You used the plastic educator to perform miraculously difficult cranial surgery.
I cried. Coronel, remember the Alamo?
I was not at the Alamo, Ramos stated.
But there was a catch in his words.
I could not have been. It was hundreds of years ago.
He added forcefully.
I was not there. I could not have been there.
Then, in the smallest of voices,
but I do remember Santa Anna, and I do remember the men I killed.
A wild alarm presented itself in his face. He swung as if to hit me with the musket, but at the last instant deflected his arc, shock and shame in his eyes. Nearly losing his footing, he steadied himself against one of the immense humming tubes.
What is this? What have you done to my mind?
I don't know, I admitted softly. But I wish to find out. Coronel, think hard. You are in a dangerous place, and I think it will soon kill you.
The doctor is mentally impaired, Topolsky said. You cannot proceed with us, Senior Midshipman Murgatroyd. Be so kind as to return him to the pinnace and see that he is confined to brig aboard the schooner.
No, Master, Ramos said calmly. He lowered the service revolver. He is right. I have been troubled. Something is wrong with me, wrong with all of us, wrong with all of this. I have been here before. Where is my scimitar?
That head injury has left you unfit for duty, Coronel, and it seems that exposure to the doctor's ranting has begun to disturb your own rational mind.
Sirs, you'd best see this, Mortlock called, interrupting Ramus's reply. Mortlock had pushed on a little further ahead than the rest of us, the light from his lamp projecting contorted, writhing shadows all about the tube-infested interior.
I've found them. The men from Europa.
Are they alive? Murgatroyd shot back urgently. There was a strain in his voice.
I'm not sure, sir. You'd best all see for yourselves, including the dog.
We caught up with Mortlock, who had gone about 50 feet further into the machine. As our lamps flashed around the spectacle he had found, so the cause for his alarmed excitement became palpable. The men from Europa were indeed here, or at least 11 of their spacesuits were. The armored, visored forms stood against two opposing, warlike surfaces facing each other. There were 5 on one side, 6 on the other, and at last I understood.